Well, it might be the whiskey talking, might be the wine, but I think that I found someone I can settle down with all my life. Once bitten and twice shy, I've been through the worst, now I wanna make you mine. A country house and a family, we can have that beautiful life. Well, it might be the whiskey talking, might be the wine, but I think that I found someone I can settle down with all my life. I've been running from the light, only darkness till you came around. Now a country house and a family, we can have that beautiful life. Well, it might be the whiskey talking, might be the wine, but I think that I found someone I can settle down with all my life. I've been running from the light, only darkness till you came around. Now I've been a country house and a family, we can have that beautiful life. Well, it might be the whiskey talking, might be the wine, but I think that I found someone I can settle down with all my life. I've been running from the light, only darkness till you came around. Now I've been found, I've been
That was a song called Found by Alberta country sensation Dan Davidson. The song was produced by Jeff Dalziel, who just happens to be my very special guest this week. My name is Stuart McKee, and this is Musicians FAQ.
You've got to love yourself before you love anybody else.
My guest this week is Jeff Dalziel, a multi-platinum and award-winning Canadian record producer, Sony ATV songwriter, and musician. Jeff is a huge supporter of Canadian music and artists, and he has produced and co-written music for labels including Warner Music Canada, Sony Music Canada, Slate Music, and Wax Records, as well as some amazing artists such as The Washboard Union, Jessica Mitchell, Dan Davidson, Chris LaBelle, Johnson's Creek, Brett Kissel, Tupelo Honey, Aaron and Amy Allen, Abby Stewart, Jim Cuddy, and many, many more. Please welcome to the show, Jeff Dalziel.
All right. My guest this week on Musicians FAQ is Jeff Dalziel. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Hey, man. It's my pleasure. Looking forward to our chat. I've had a couple of guests on now that that I believe you've worked with and produced with Aaron Allen and Amy Allen and Abby Stewart prior to that.
Very nice.
So I thought it might be a kind of a nice little wrap-up to have you in shortly after their interviews. And what we'd like to do with this interview, I mean, just always go back to the beginning and kind of find out where the influences were. Where were you born? What was your childhood like?
Yeah, I was born in Fresno, California. So I'm actually a dual citizen still. Funny enough, I'm so, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, I really, really, really support Canadian talent. Like, everybody that plays on my singles or records, or I try to make it 100% Canadian all the time. It's funny because I'm actually half American. So it's, but I was, I'm basically a road baby, which we can get into later. So I was born in Fresno, lived there for a little while, but then there's more travels that we can get into if you want. But all through this, you know, southern states, and then ended up in Clearwater, Florida, and then here in Canada. But I was pretty young still though, at the time.
Okay, welcome.
Yeah.
And what were things like around your household when you were a kid?
Music. My father was a musician. While he was being a musician, he actually started a management company at times. So he managed bands like Wednesday. Do you remember that band?
I don't know if I remember them, but
they had that. They put out Last Kiss as well. It did really well. It's a bunch of, I don't even remember the bands. I was so young at the time. So there was musicians around all the time, music, instruments. So that's why I kind of gravitated towards, like, I was already playing instruments by the time I was 8 or something, tons of different instruments, but I didn't know what I was doing, but they were there, and it was, the house was just, it was musical, very musical.
Right. Cool. So, your mom as well? Or?
No, my mom, did not, she was not a musician at all. So she just,
she was, I think, she a fan of music or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sure. I think at the time she was probably real estate, I think at the time, but that's, you know, and stay at home mom kind of thing, kind right. of both. Yeah. So yeah. More, encouraging.
Well, that's good. More of a practical mind though.
Yeah.
And any siblings at all?
I have a brother and a sister. My brother's quite musical too. He didn't follow the path. He's more of he makes custom welded wood furniture stuff for high end customers. It's really nice. My sister is, she works for a company in Montreal, or she was in Montreal. So that's, that's it. So,
all right.
Very good. Neither one took music. I guess I was a good example. Don't do it.
Yeah, no kidding. So a lot of different instruments around. I mean, do you remember what was the first instrument that you really took to?
First instruments I took to were drums and piano, because those were readily available in my house. I took piano lessons, but I didn't really like that vibe. I was more just, because I had spent time just kind of meandering on the instrument, I was already kind of had it under my fingers, both drums and piano. But piano, you know, everybody wants their kid to take piano lessons. So, of course, my father, being a great pianist himself, thought it might be a good thing to push me down that path. But I lost my books on purpose, so I wouldn't have to go. Because I didn't like my teacher. She was kind of mean and nasty. And I didn't like the, even at a young age, I didn't think music should be boxed in. I don't know how to explain it. I wish I'd, you know, listened more and became more of a classical pianist, but maybe not. Maybe that helped me just break the, I don't have to sit in a box, you know? So. Right.
Yeah. It's interesting. I remember, I guess about 20 plus years ago, Paul McCartney started getting into some classical stuff and doing arias and things. And the guy that he was working with was classically trained, obviously, and had offered to teach him how to read and write music formally. And he said, I can do it pretty quickly with you. And he said, no, you know what? He goes, my system's worked for me for years and I don't want to jinx it. Yeah. And he goes, I think there's something for that. I mean, I've had sketch formal training along the way, but I think you tend to experiment and, like you said, push outside the box a little bit more when you have
it. Yeah. I mean, I took that. Yeah. I take the approach that those greats, which is an endless list. I can't really picture them getting it. Like they didn't go to a school to study all the people that they were, you know, competing with at the time, let's just say, because I'm sure there was some competition there. So I appreciate it and I love it, but I think, I mean, we can talk more about it. I've done over 200 plus TV shows and movies in my life as a composer. So, and I don't have any classical training either. So, because I was immersed in such a large amount of music growing up, including classical, I just felt it. And so it's just like, I wasn't following the architecture that's set before us. And I'm not, you know, pissing on people that want to do that. I just think thinking back, I'm kind of glad I didn't go, well, you got to do it like this, you got to do it like this. And some people are just too rigid with it. And some people, I think, they can learn it and then just break free of it and do their thing. So mind you, having said that, maybe if I was better classically trained, I might have made things a little quicker, but they might have been, because a lot of it's like trial and error and screwing it up. And,
right.
But I've somehow got on a path to do a ton of TV and movies before I was even 20. So, you know, so it's, yeah. Anyways, there you go. Yeah. There you go. So training, I did take drum lessons from Sally Chappas. She was fantastic. She was one of the last drummers from Blood, Sweat and Tears. And I knew her through my dad and tons of people. She was fantastic. So she really helped me hone my drum skills, which is my main instrument, by the way. So originally, so drums and piano originally, and then picked up guitar later.
Right. But, and I think that's, I mean, I could be wrong. I mean, a lot of the producers that I'm aware of, drumming does seem to be sort of one of the main instruments. Keyboards certainly help, I guess, as far as composing,
yes,
structuring and organizing.
Things. Even players, like I've worked with tons of guys over the years that were, you know, the main guitar player in a band are unbelievable. And then a bass player who's even currently Justin Cutting from Brett Kissel's band. He's the MD there. One of the best bass players around. You got to hear him play drums. And the same with a guitar player. They sit down and play and go, what are you doing? What? It's like, so I think a lot of kids, you know, there's a lot of, maybe there's something to it. I'm not saying that people aren't great guitar players because they didn't play drums. They're great guitar players without that.
Right.
But I've often come across a lot of great musicians that started playing drums. I don't know what the connection is. Maybe it's a rhythmic thing. For me, I'd rather things be in time and out of tune than in tune and out of time. So
yeah,
there's something to that.
I agree.
Yeah.
So now as far as like the movie composing and TV shows and things like that, was that sort of you in a room with your tools kind of doing everything? Or are you working with other musicians or?
Well, no. Okay. So yeah, this is a kind of a long answer to that, but I'll try to make it really quick. Because of my father, I was really introduced to electronic music before anybody knew it really existed. So before there was even an Apple computer. So we had Alpha Centauri computers in our basement at home with ribbon cables coming out of it to keyboards and just crazy stuff. Like nobody was doing it yet. And so, so my father actually, he was asked from his friend who developed, I don't know if you remember what the Fairlight is. Fairlight is literally the first real big workstation of keyboard, computer, sounds, all that stuff. It was all in one. It was super expensive. But they asked him to come and pick the piano because he was, at the time, like everybody knew him as a player. So he picked the actual keyboard that goes in this unit. So I ended up having a Fairlight in my house when I was 13, maybe.
Oh, cool.
And so I'm sampling. And this is the stuff like Sledgehammer and stuff like that from Peter Gabriel. So I have access to these sounds. I have no clue what I'm doing what I'm doing. That might slip out a few times. Sorry. I'll clean it up. But it's just being, by the time it became somewhat more commercially viable and available, I wasn't afraid of it. It was like, I was already just kind of messing around with stuff. And
right.
Why can't I make this do this? I wanted to make it do this. And so when the tools got easier. So I really had the jump on electronic computer music before anybody in this country. So I entered into doing films and stuff because I knew that gear so well. Like, I mean, the quick answer to that is I knew it so well. I was managing drums and keyboards along McQuaid and in Oshawa. My clientele was coming from all over Ontario just because they needed to know this information.
Sure.
And so a lot of people would, you know, I'd get bigger clients from Toronto that wanted me to put together a rig for TV and film so they can learn, so they could use that new technology, you know? And I designed a system for them, put it together, have it delivered, show up, set it up, lock it to tape, put on a car chase, and I do this drum thing and show them. They're all going, can you just come and do that for us? So that's how I kind of got into it, because the musical part, I just knew, but I also knew the computer part. And there's this young punk kid that's just, you know, not only can run the gear, but actually is as good a musician as the people buying the gear. Like now thinking back, that's what it was like. I didn't know that then, but they're like, hey, can you just come and do that? And so I started working with doesn't matter who, but tons of composers in Toronto, and cut my teeth there and then started doing films and TV with an actual partner that was originally one of those clients. And we made tons and tons of stuff together. So it was fun. So, so then the arc of that, taking that to commercial music was, I became the guy that to fix the problems in the analog studio. Can you come and lift off all this music? So before there was Pro Tools, I'm lifting off multi-tracks and putting and cutting into samples on different keyboards and layers. And I used to show up to studios with four or five fridge size racks full of samplers just to pull. And it was like the Matrix. There's no waveforms. I had to piece it all back together with MIDI in a computer with numbers and then play it back. And then we can add and cut and paste them. And at that point, they're like, well, I just got hired for a lot of that stuff, and which made me meet or help, allowed me to meet people in more of the record side of things. And then I would get called all the time to come and fix their woes. And they're like, well, you know, and that at that time, Sony was like, well, can you just come and do that with us? Can you come and stay here? And because they were already dealing with artists I've been working with in terms of writing and producing and stuff. So it was just like, it became a thing. So I started doing programming and computer stuff for Sony, fixing their stuff. And at that point, the A&R was like, yeah, can you just come and work with us forever and ever and ever? And it just, then it was all downhill from them, but.
Yeah, you're like a gold mine. Yeah. They discovered that.
Well, yeah, it's not, I'm nothing probably special. For me, the musical part is the more special part. Like right. That's what kept me in the game. But the technology certainly got me in the door. So I think, you know, there's a good lesson in that for everybody. Learn how to do it. Doesn't mean you have to be great at it. Just do it. Well, and if your musicality is fantastic, then you're going to stay around.
Yeah, so. I think that's a lot of people are just intimidated by it, and they just see you do it and all this machinery, and they just got to, I don't want to learn that. Let's just bring him in.
Well, at the time, absolutely, for sure, at the time. Now people are a little less, especially the pandemic has forced artists. We can get into that. I love that. Because now we can speak more on musical terms rather than talking. You know, they can kind of just do something and go, I can go, okay, I get what you're talking about. Let's do it. Amazing. So that's, you know, that's helpful. I think I encourage any artist out there to just, you don't need much. I mean, if you have a laptop, you probably have GarageBand already. And that GarageBand is a light version of Logic X, which is something people use. And not many people know this, but Umbrella by Rihanna was pretty much done 95% in GarageBand. So it's not about the tools. It's about the song and the artist and that performance. So yeah, don't be afraid of it. Just have fun.
Yeah, I've heard that over the years, that many songs that you've, big hits and things that you thought were studio productions were done in GarageBand and simple things like that. And I mean,
yeah, didn't Kendrick Lamar's producer win a Grammy from a song that he did in his iPhone?
Yeah.
GarageBand. Yeah, it's crazy. So the tool, that's what I try to tell everybody. The tool, they go, what system should I use? It doesn't matter. The tool is not going to give you the success. It's this and your heart and performances that are going to matter. It doesn't matter. So I tell people now, you can give me a 4-track cassette thing and I'll still compete for sure.
Yeah.
It's about what I'm recording, not how I'm recording.
Yeah. So, well, and I remember when those little Tascams and things came out, I had a Fostex and then I had a little Tascam.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, I've got a studio. And this is back in the 80s and the little drum machine. And you know, you just thought you were the shit all of a sudden. But it's, you know, and Springsteen recorded Nebraska on a little 4-track Tascam back in the
70s. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and look what George Martin recorded on.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Compared to what we have now.
Well, that's so, what you're reminding me of all those, you know, when you're talking about that stuff. And they had, you know, pictures of all the Beatles in the control room and everybody's got their hand on a slider and everybody's got their hand on a button and they're all working in sync. And yeah.
Yeah. I remember kind of those days, but not that old school, but definitely there was no automation back in the day. It's everybody ready to make their moves and we're recording to tape. That's, you know, that really happened, you know.
Yeah.
Editing for me on computers was an easy transition because I already been editing tape, multi-track tape with a razor blade. And we knew all that stuff prior to the tools that we have today. And the tools we have today really came, hasn't been that long. So it seems like it's been here forever, but it hasn't. And
right.
You know, anyways, sorry, we can move on from technology. Don't want to bore everybody.
Yeah, it's a
couple, gets you back on track.
It is. It's a couple of sessions just in itself.
But for sure.
One last note on that. And this has happened a few times when I'm recording at home and you accidentally hit record and record over something. And I have that moment of panic because I flash back to the 80s when we had an old studio.
Yeah.
And I was like, Oh yeah, it doesn't matter. I can just hit undo.
Yeah. Not that anybody is going to know. You can cut this out, but if you want. But yeah, you don't understand terror until you've wiped out the SMPTE track on a 24 track machine, and now you had to wait to lock. You got to figure out and lock it up again. And, oh, what a nightmare. Anyways, seen that happen. I didn't do it. The assistant did. But anyways.
Yeah, I barely made it through high school. Well, you know I can't say that mama never raised no fool. And in the grand scheme of things, well, it's safe to say I really don't know a lot. Well, hell, I guess you do your best with whatever the hell you got. And I know a lot about a mapped out town and where we go when the sun goes down. And I know a lot what it takes to keep a good-hearted woman around. And I can tell you about the feeling I get when that boat hits the fiddle. Well, I may not know a lot, but I know a lot about a little.
Jason Benoit with A Lot About a Little, another great song produced by Jeff Dalziel.
All right. So getting back again a little bit to childhood, you're talking about moving around a lot, which seems to be kind of a common theme with a lot of people. A lot of creative people in the music industry is either a lot of angst in their childhood or a lot of music around or a lot of moving around. In some cases, two of those or three of those. So tell me a little bit about the traveling and moving around. So born in Fresno.
Yeah, I was born in Fresno. I can't remember what time when we left there, but we ended up moving to Vegas. Well, okay, but let me to why this trek happened is because at the time, my dad was playing with Robbie Robertson, so he was his B3 guy, I believe, and piano to some degree. So we're touring across southern U.S. just after I was born. So we ended up in Vegas for a while, and just probably some small little towns that I don't even aware of, not even aware of, but settled more or less. Fresno, Vegas, Nashville, and then Florida finally, and then up here. So, and you know, music has surrounded my entire life. There's no way I could have escaped it. So I'm sure my dad loved it. My mom wasn't so thrilled about it. She was supportive, but you know, it's still like, you know, their marriage didn't work out. And for whatever reason, music, money, who knows? So I was kind of caught in the middle. Like I'm like him and they don't get along. And so music is bad. And so I ended up like helping her ease her stress. I went to school for chemical engineering. And then when I don't want to do this, I want to do the music thing again. So it worked out fine. But
yeah, it comes back. It's probably like the mother who's married to a cop, and then the son goes on to college and then wants to become a cop. And she's like, oh no.
Exactly. But she's, you know, she's not that she's apologized, but she's like, okay, I was wrong. You did it. So it's cool. But she's still my worst critic when it comes to music. It's hilarious. So despite her not being musical, she has a really good ear. Like she's usually pretty right. I'll play something. I can't get any bullshit past her. It's like, nah, I don't believe it. Well, she doesn't talk like that. You know what I mean?
But that's a good thing. I mean, I find a lot of parents kind of go the other way and, oh, my kid is so talented and they're so great. Yeah. And a lot of times they're not. And I think, you know, you need to hear that. You need to have somebody in your life that you can trust that's going to say, you know, my parents could sometimes be very supportive, but they could sometimes say, that stinks, man.
But
so they can tell you why too. And that's, I think, the more important
thing. Yeah, she had this thing. It's almost like she had a better sense of what's going to work with the marketplace than my own father did. So who was a musician, but I get that because we're musicians. We kind of really don't care, but we want to be successful. So that's a lesson I'm trying to teach artists all the time. We could talk about that later if you'd like.
Yeah.
Anyways, go ahead. Did I hope I answered your question?
No, yeah, for sure it did. Well, and it's interesting because I think, and you got a bit back to that with talking about the readily accessible technology and how, especially during the lockdown, a lot of people are getting more and more into it because it really is a DIY world. And I mean, you know, from your end of, you've got the technology, you've got the music. I mean, obviously you've developed a big business sense over the years as well. You really kind of need all those things. And I know, you know, talking to Aaron Allen, and you know, he went on in great detail about you and what it was like working for you. And the same sort of thing, almost like what you're talking about with your mother, that you couldn't get anything past you. I mean, it was, he talked about the cowboy boot camp that you put him through for a couple of years. And it really,
some artists love that. And then some artists are not so keen on that, but you know, I don't have to talk about who, but yeah, sorry. Continue your thought. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that was really kind of it. I mean, I think that's kind of the key, is that you've got that strong mentor or that figure who's kind of saying, yeah, you've got talent and there's something there, but I mean, if you're going to settle with that, you're not going to make it. So here's what you really need to get to. And
yeah, I have to think all I'm trying to do is fill the void for as many artists that want to hear my voice and talk about things. I'm not saying I'm 100% right, but all I'm trying to do is fill a void that doesn't exist in our industry right now. And I'm not poo-pooing any A&R people, because those people are not dealing with A&R people, right, unless they sign to a record company. So, but there's this sort of the DIY and the independent industry couldn't be stronger than it is now. It was fantastic. I can explain indie when I was younger, whole other world. So artists are kind of getting shoved into the spotlight without any filter system for their material. And sometimes it works for them and sometimes it could be hurting them or working against them. Sure. And I come from, luckily for me, that's not egotistical, but I was more talented than most people around me vying for the same opportunities. Doesn't mean I'm amazing. It's just that, you know, it worked. But it still needed to be refined. And I had some fantastic mentors along the way. One of them was my head of A&R at Sony. When I worked there, I learned, even though I was really successful going into that seat as an in-house producer, the lessons I learned from Mike Roth and the head of Sony ATV Publishing, Gary Furness, I learned some amazing things even without them telling me sometimes. Like I learned that artists, if they want to be successful, they have to stop and understand that we, up until now, we've been making music for ourselves. If we want success, we have to include the people that don't know how to do what we do. And if we're not preachy about it and we make them feel included, and the more people we can include, the more successful you get. It's really that simple. It's like, if I'm going to make music that only this many people can identify with or love, there's nothing wrong with that. That's why there's jazz. I grew up, I love jazz. I played for my whole life in jazz stuff. And I, there's nothing like that feeling shredding up on there. Doesn't matter who I play with, but it's just that free form thing. But it is a very small demographic to some degree, comparatively speaking to, you know, commercially successful things. Like, so it's about getting artists to understand that there is mathematics to commercially viable music. And not that I want to turn any artist into Katy Perry or anything, unless I'm working with Katy Perry, but they have to understand that the wider the scope you, the wider the net you cast, the more chance of big success. And a lot of that comes down to songs. I find now that too much emphasis is on the artist to write the songs, perform the songs, be the manager, be the promoter, be the marketing. And we're all sitting back, everybody's sitting back going, let's just see how your metrics work before we do anything. And that's unfortunate because nobody's there to tell them that your song is, your baby's ugly. Yeah. But I know you can produce some pretty beautiful babies. So let me try to give you some tips on how I've done it in the past and how other people have worked on it in the past, and then go off, do your thing. And then when you're ready, we'll hook you up with some people that are doing it. And just sort of, basically I tell artists, they need to tear them down and build them back up. Like tear them down, get rid of the stuff that's hurting them and help them become a better musician, writer, and human being. And then, and it seems to work if people listen. Not that I'm a guru of anything. I'm just a product of all my mentors. And so really the Cowboy Boot Camp is literally just a condensed version that I can tune in personally to whoever it is I'm working with. So it's kind of, so every process with every artist is slightly different because I have to take their attitudes and their brain into consideration as well. It's not just like a one size fits all. So,
right. Yeah.
That's but it is getting them to understand that we are making the size of our success is purely dependent on the size of the audience that will understand what's coming out of your face.
Sure.
Literally, that's it. So it's not rocket science, but some people constantly create it like they're putting the boulders in front of themselves without even noticing or knowing. So
yeah. That's interesting.
And I just try to clear it. And if they don't want to do it, then there's lots of producers that'll take your money. So
that's right. Oh yeah. There's no shortage of people who promise you the world and deliver nothing. But
yeah, it's like I think I'm sure Aaron probably told you how long it took to do that stuff. And some artists might even get a little worried and concerned. And it's like, why is it taking so long? Cause it's taking so long.
Yeah.
It took me 20 years. You talked to me like 6 months ago. I can't, there's no magic wand. You got to do the work. And then if you do the work, then you're going to end up being the best you can be at this time. I can guarantee that we'll make something the best thing you've ever heard. And then the world will decide.
There's a great quote that you had on Instagram. Things I know for sure. For an artist, their brand and their future, the most important algorithm is constantly making music and growing an actual fan base. Which I think ties into what you're talking about. But yeah, there's so much more that goes into it. And I think it's such a, today's generation is such an immediate gratification, everybody, you know, and because they have these tools and they see everybody else become an instant star, so to speak. And although I don't think most things don't usually happen instantly, there's a lot going on behind the scenes. And
well, I think the payoff is as potentially misguided, what's the word I'm looking for? What seems to be successful might not be as successful as you think. And I can qualify that statement in a second, but okay. So basically what I'm saying is that you were right. Everybody's quick to be famous, and that's very rarely is that going to work out. And if it looks like it's famous to you online, it's just like people look like they're having their best. Like Facebook, Instagram are versions of everybody's perfect life if it existed, right? Right. It's like, yeah, I can rent the cars. I can go and take the pictures and the shots. And so really, we all already know to some degree, those platforms are really kind of dishing up a bit of fake news. So the problem, the other problem that exists with the social media stardom thing is these are worldwide platforms. And I'll just I just talked about this on another panel once, or for London Music Awards, actually. Somebody was bringing up TikTok. And so I just said to you, like, a lot of the people in the industry are sitting back waiting to see what Abby's numbers are or whatever somebody's numbers are to jump in and do something. Well, we also live in a time when those numbers start to mean something. We don't really need any help anymore. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword for these people, which they'll learn. But at the same time, I'll give you an example of, there was an, I won't say the artist, but this was at Sony at the time. There was this new thing called YouTube. Yeah. And we had just gone through the whole Napster thing, and the peer-to-peer really, really did take a bite out of our business, which is a whole other conversation, a whole other podcast. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, there's this YouTube thing. And we had an artist. We found an artist that had millions of views on YouTube within a month with an amazing video and a great song, great guy. And Sony jumped on that and developed him for months, spent a lot of money, released it, and nobody cared.
Wow.
And you think, well, why is that? How is that? And we quickly realized, well, YouTube is worldwide. It's a vacuum. And so there's 2 million people. What's the population of the world right now?
8 billion.
Yeah. What's 2 million is like not even a, you can't, it's not even a fraction that we care about. And that small fraction could be spread across that many people in that many places in the world. Where do you sell a ticket? Where do you sell a thing? And so we learned very quickly in the earlier part of the industry that those numbers are, it's nice to have for promo value, but it doesn't guarantee sales. It doesn't guarantee filling seats in a show, or it does not guarantee a fan base. Now, combine that with the ADHD factor of people. Like, they're just like, now, I'm going to go now. I'm going to go now. Yeah. So like, just because you had 10 million views on TikTok, people forgot you like tomorrow.
Yes.
And so the real connection, the real artists historically, even now, are the ones that connect to a fan. And then that fan brings another fan, and it's like that you grow. I mean, Terry McBride had a great speech on core audience things. If anybody wants to go find that, he managed Avril Lavigne and Sarah McLachlan. And so he was really big on the core fan base thing. And that's because it's inherently what it's always been, and it still always will be. You can have some quick flash success, but if you want to have a career, you actually do have to connect with a fan base, not necessarily in person, but you need to connect with them musically and shows, and you got to know where they are, and you got to kind of build from there. And eventually then you have a big enough core audience, a good fan base. You can put out something that's crappy and they'll forgive you.
Yes.
If you put out something crappy now on Instagram, you're dead tomorrow. And now, not only did they forgot about you. Oh yeah, that guy. Oh, that's terrible. Next. And they'll never say your name ever again. So yeah. It's like, it's instant gratification. Oh yeah. So I think it's even more important for artists to understand that I would rather you have 100 solid fans that would always come to your show, buy the new t-shirt and the hat, than have 10,000 streams on TikTok. Like, the remuneration's better with good, small, solid fans than there are large who cares fans.
Yeah, I find that. I mean, I've got, you know, like a lot of people, huge playlists, and I'll like and follow people and put a song in my playlist or in my favorites. But at the end of the day, there's probably only 10% of that, those hundreds of artists that I actually listen to on a regular basis. You know, the same thing with podcasts and everything else. Now, with the metrics today, I mean, you can start to see where the fan base
we had to learn quickly back at Sony how we can, you know, monetize this. And so there was companies called Big Champagne at the time. I don't know if they're still available, where you can actually, we saw data that an American band that had sold millions of records was getting dropped because their new record didn't sell millions of records. But they could show us, this company showed us the data that they had, and they would show the data of illegal and legal downloads combined. So yeah, one major city had 1.2 million illegal or 1.2 million downloads. Probably 80% were illegal at the time, but that's at the band's fault. So the popularity was still there. The sales weren't there.
Right.
And so if there's no, hey man, if you can have tons of internet success and you can find where they are, guess where you're going to tour? Because if you don't, then it was pointless. And so you're going to go, oh, well, I put out the song from, I live in Barrie and I put it out, but most of my fans are in Michigan. Well, I guess you better go live in Michigan for a while and build it out. So yeah. I think I want to try to connect those dots for artists, really. And I'm never trying to be negative about it, but look, I mean, even Carly, I love Carly Rae. I've worked with Carly Rae Jepsen back in Idol time, the Idol stuff. And she put out Call Me Maybe, which is arguably one of the biggest exports this country's ever seen, but it was viral. It went viral at the time. Her second single, because the song was more popular than she was. And I feel bad for her because she's super talented, amazing, awesome person. And I would have loved to have her be the benefactor of that. But because of that swipe left thing, it's like it became the song and people are singing the song and they're dancing around. And that's really what became, the song became famous, not Carly. And I feel really bad for that. So again, if she had built a fan base up and slowly and then dropped that puppy, then it would have been like all her fans would have doubled and tripled quickly. But now it's like, well, they don't even know who the singer is. They're just watching this video. And that, to me, I thought that was very sad. And I don't want to see artists make that same mistake again, you know?
I used to love the way that you had to leave, the tricks you had up your sleeve. I guess it was so naive to think I was good enough to get you to stay every day and keep you away from the life you're keeping and the lies we're weaving through an endless cycle of best kept secrets. Maybe it's the way she calls you baby, maybe it's the way I don't
Well, that was just beautiful. That was Jessica Mitchell with Maybe It's Me, another great artist that Jeff worked with.
I don't know. I was pretty young, probably 7 or 8, somewhere around there, I think, maybe. Something like that.
Yeah. And where'd you guys end up?
Grew up? Oshawa, Ontario.
Yeah.
Which I live here again.
Okay.
I moved to Toronto, worked 3 years, and then came back here. And now it's nice and comfy and cozy. And it's nice. Not too far. But Oshawa was my grow-up town for sure.
So did you do bands yourself along the way? Did you play in
bands? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All the time. Yeah. Basement bands, rock and roll. I still talk to some of Pete Lesperance, actually, who's part of Smoking Ashes with Aaron.
Yep.
I've known Pete since we were 14. Musicians, both from Oshawa. Now he's plays on all my country singles for me. Washboard, everybody. He's been on all that stuff. And now he's producing and writing stuff too. He's been great with that. So a lot of Oshawa musicians are out there, and I still keep in touch and try to get them on things. And it's kind of cool. So, and then, I played in a Ukrainian wedding band for years. That's how
we're getting
paid for my life. It was great. And then, country bands.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was doing country bands, the whole Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday matinee, Sunday matinee, Saturday night. It was crazy. Like, it was always music. So much so that I would be in trouble when I was late for band practice at high school because I had a gig and they knew I had the gig the night before. So I've made a music teacher angry that I was busy making music. It was like that much going on. So yeah, it kept me out of trouble. I mean, I just played hockey and made music, and I didn't get into anything nefarious. So it was kind of neat. Music. I'm still like that. So
yeah. So there was never any doubt. I mean, music was always what you're going to do, and there was no sort of, or had you dreamed about being a hockey player or other things? Or
yeah, my hockey, I still coach hockey. Like, I love coaching. I do house league because it's a little less stress. It's not, AAA and, traveling in tournaments. This is more like giving back and learning, teaching kids and having a blast with that. So I love hockey. So I think I kind of knew even, it got to the point where my parents were separated at the time and I was graduating, moving up the hockey rung, playing, AAA hockey myself. And I had pretty good record as a goalie, but equipment at the time was very, very expensive and we couldn't afford it. And it was kind of like, I don't know if I really passionate enough to just push through to be a pro,
Right. Yeah.
But I did have the connections. I worked for the Oshawa Generals at the time, selling programs actually. So I knew the whole people. I knew Sherry Bass and all those people, family, friends, everything. So I'm sure had I kept up with it, I might've been able to do a tryout. Maybe I would end up I was definitely probably good enough to play for the Gens. Yeah. And then whether that turns into NHL, it's harder to become a musician than it is. It's harder to become the hockey player than it is a musician. So to some degree. So it would have been just as hard a path. Thank God I didn't try that. Maybe I'd be certainly more wealthy if I'd have made it to they get paid a lot of money. Anyways. There was nothing really that took me off the music path other than what I told you, my mom, that pressure of
the schooling. Yeah.
You need to have a real job. You need to have a real thing. It's like, yeah, you're probably right. Okay. I'll go to school for coming. Did that. And yeah, it's okay. So I'd either be producing music now or making boner pills for Pfizer. I don't know, whatever. Can I say boner pills? Sorry.
I think so.
Other than that, I'd be making drugs for some pharmaceutical company. That's right, what right. I'd be doing. So I prefer the music part.
You might've developed today's vaccine. Yeah. So were there, I mean, obviously a lot of music around you, but were there certain songs beyond and artists and bands beyond, what you're being exposed to with your family and with your dad? Was there something that just grabbed you and said, wow, this is.
Fortunately for me, because of my dad and my mom, my mom was a huge fan of music stuff and really, really great taste. So I can tell you my first, all I listened to for years when I was a kid was Steve Miller, Joker, yeah. Dark Side of the Moon, and probably Kiss Alive or something, and AC/DC.
Nice. I've got them all on vinyl from back in the day.
I would literally just put it on, put my headphones in the dark, and that's where I lived. Probably those three or four of those records every day for years and years and years. And so right there, you can see the span of the music. I was not gravitating towards any one specific genre of music. I just loved the way music made me feel. So And so I do have, it's funny because I can tell people I have more accolades. Like right now I'm known quite because of country, but I have more accolades in rock and pop because of my Sony years and some of the stuff you, if you research, go look at the site, my site, you go, wow, you did that one. You did that. It's like, it's all over the map. So I'm comfortable producing in any genre because my whole life has been every genre. And so I get same lessons, same plans, same mathematics. It just, as long as I get the feels, then it's right. And so I'm always, as a producer, trying to recreate that, the feels I got listening to Dark Side of the Moon in the Pitch Dark with the headphones on. You know, it's like you, like, until you do that. And if you, anybody out there listening, you do that, put on whatever, block the sun, so you can't see anything, just put that on. And all you have is that sense. If you don't get the feels, then you don't get the feels. But if you do, that's what I'm trying to do every time I make music. And so with an artist like Aaron or anybody else, it's like, until I'm feeling at least a bit of that, we haven't hit it yet. And it's not my fault. It's not yours. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm not saying I'm right. But do you feel that yet? No? Well, let's make sure we get that.
That's brilliant.
So, yeah.
Now, do you still listen to music today, like looking for new
artists? All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. Yeah. My morning consists of, every morning I listen to the top 20 of rock, pop, and country. So 60 songs, and that changes every week a little bit so I can get used to it. So, and my artist will tell you that, Aaron would tell you the same thing. That's part of the boot camp. They should be doing the same thing because I want to be inspired by what's going on now. I also want to be aware of what my competition is. I always want to keep up with the Joneses to some degree, just so, but not like, if I'm working, I'll listen to all that stuff, but then I don't listen to music all day. I work on what I'm working on, and it's just sort of like a loose, all these different genres are speaking to me and there's no one thing. And so it helps me again, make what I want to do, not what Chopin used to do. Or we studied Tchaikovsky. This is what you got structured. I don't want to structure. I want to just feel my way through it and then get the feels. There you go. So the more I have talking to me in the universe while I'm working on projects, the better. So it's, so there's that. And then, yeah, I'll often just late at night, just put on some music and quietly come out to my flame table here or whatever, just chill and listen to music, right? Or movies. I love listening to just watching movies because the music is always so fantastic. So even a bad score is good scores. I've got a lot of those. I made a lot of bad scores. But anyways, it's that can also be very inspiring too.
So yeah, I found that last few years, some of my favorite songs have been, you know, in a Netflix movie or whatever. It just, I can't wait till the end to get to the credits and go, like, who was that? And they discover it.
Yes. Yeah. No, I know. Yeah.
Sometimes being surprised that it's actually an artist I know, I just hadn't heard the song, and I thought, dude, I thought they sounded familiar, but
yeah. There's some great stuff. I have been inspired by just watching a TV series, and like, wow, that's a cool drum groove. I got to remember something like that. It's like, listen to it a few times, go down, play it, record something like that, just put it away for later. So
it seems like everybody's probably looking for the next. I mean, you're saying back in the day where YouTube first wasn't taken seriously, and then everybody was kind of putting all their money on YouTube, and then it becomes TikTok and all these other things, and then Netflix stars are taking off. And where do you kind of see the trends going?
Well, if my history of watching the ebb and flow of the industry is any indication of the future, I can only speculate that, you know, to the rebuttal to that YouTube thing I told you about, was, okay, we've got to get back to making music and promoting it and marketing it and finding unique things. And right after, you know, then we end up, you know, with Our Lady Peace Records and stuff, like, they're huge. And like, we got back to more of that kind of thing for a while. And I think people would be bitten by this for a while. They'll sign the TikTok star, they'll do this, and then they'll realize we just wasted a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Let's get back to that. So I think, just for artists out there, if they just kind of keep afloat and keep making, so go back to the quote, that things I know for sure. Mm-hmm. It's about constantly making strides in your music and your writing and get better at it. It's like, I don't expect you to be a great writer, because I'm not a great writer. I'm signed to ATV Publishing for Sony. And if somebody could show me how to write a hit tomorrow, thank you. I've been trying for years. So it's a hit and miss. And so I try to get the pressure off of that. Just get better and better and better and keep going. So when the industry goes, you know what, I like this Aaron Allen guy, he's got millions of streams, got lots of metrics, let's pick him up and let's put in $250,000 marketing and promoting, so now more people would be exposed to him. So it is a numbers game. You could have great music and not enough people are exposed to it.
Right.
Which is classic. I mean, there's been so many independent artists back in our day that we never even knew of. That's like, and it was only word of mouth. And that can work too, because we witnessed Metallica winning a Grammy and nobody knew who they were.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and then the same thing again with recently was Arcade Fire. Like they win a Grammy, it's like they're showing people in the audience, like, ooh. It's like, so there is ground. This is going back to what I'm talking about. Get, make better music, grow your fan base. That will give you a career. It's a longer boat potentially, but it's a more secure boat. It's not going to be leaky. So if you get instant success on one of the, whatever today's social media craze is going to be very, very short, short-lived. You get your 15 minutes of fame, and then the next person who can swallow 12 golf balls right. Is just taking your headline spot. So, can you imagine being a musician and every day, like tomorrow there's somebody bigger than you or better than you or funnier than you? It's like, you can't compete with that and grow a fan base. Those things are fantastic for quick promo. And then everybody who's all your fans goes, see, we were right. And then it just sort of grows even bigger. And that's, you know, that there you go.
Payday, meeting the boys at my place. All cleaned up, pile in the truck, man, and I can barely wait. Hear the band roar from across the dance floor. Like they know that something good is on the way. It's a Friday night like any other. You walk in a stare and a stutter. Every single time you look at me, I need a fix, a true companion. Jimmy Beamer, old Jack Daniels, anything to set me on my way. Drinking up my courage, whiskey for my nerves. Got me drunk on your short summer dress, ballroom ballerina. I'm gonna need another shot of glory. Ain't no turning back. Got me high on your tipsy smile and your hips all swinging. We start spinning, spinning, spinning. Well, I take the first step, praying that I don't trip. Up on my words, just think of something smart to say. Take a deep breath, even though I'm scared to death. I don't care, cause I just gotta know your name. I need a fix, a true companion. Jimmy Beam or old Jack Daniels. Something strong to stop these shaking knees. Drinking up my courage, whiskey for my nerves. Got me drunk on your short summer dress, ballroom ballerina. I'm gonna need another shot of glory. Ain't no turning back. Got me high on your tipsy smile and your hips all swinging. We start spinning, spinning, spinning. Short summer dress, ballroom ballerina. I'm gonna need another shot of glory. Hey.